mechanics of the bodily stimuli. It is rather an inquiry on the essence of being, on life, on the nature of the subject-object and mind-body dichotomies. Critical historiographies on the senses, as well as several anthropological studies, have shown that the sensorium, with its five senses and its implicit hierarchy, is a Western folk taxonomy, and we inherited it since classical antiquity. It is a way of imagining the self and the body, an imagery that in colonial and national imagination, in modernity, took on a rigid form. This prevailing conception of the sense in Western modernity, however, carried certain class connotations. It had mostly to do with the upper and middle classes, whereas there were other subaltern sensorial regimes that defied sensorial hierarchy and compartmentalization. Furthermore, this fixity and regimentation has been challenged in late modernity, especially since the beginning of the 20th century, by new social forces, new technologies, new configurations of materiality. Things can be described as the extensions of the human body. They can act as sensorial prostheses. This is not meant to devalue their power and agency, but rather to foreground and highlight their ability to enable the body to expand its sensorial capabilities. And since things are infinite, sensorial modalities are also infinite. Several unrecognized sensorial modalities have been defined and analyzed by anthropology, cultural studies, or other fields. The sense of temperature, the sense of balance and movement, kinesthesia, and the sense of cinema, synesthesia with C, are some of them. We can go on adding, for example, the sense of place. The specific experiential mode associated with the emplacement of human action, its grounding in specific locales, the familiarity that such a grounding brings, the almost instinctive and automatic sense of sensorial recognition of paths and routes and features, the gathering and the harboring of memories and places. All sensorial experiences are synesthetic, but also kinesthetic. All involve movement as well as the commingling and the combined work of several senses. Sensorial modalities are thus are infinite, not only because of the infinity of things, but also because of the infinite number of contextual situations and locales where sensorial experience take place. Now, the implications of this thesis are immense. In the same way that anthropologists have identified sensorial modalities unrecognized by the Western sensorium, archaeologists, having primary access to the materiality of the world through time, to the infinite number and range of things and technologies, can unearth and explore sensorial modalities which have been ignored and suppressed by Western modernity. Given the synesthetic nature and character of sensoriality, however, this will have to be done without resorting to the enumeration and the singularization of the sensorial. Now that you have been to the museum, let me take you to the site itself. But as we ascend the hill and pass the monumental entrance, be very careful. The slope is very slippery. You are prohibited again from touching the marble, but at least your feet can touch the ground, the polished rock, reminding you that before civilization, before the classical, before even the prehistoric citadel that stood in this place, this was geology, bedrock, pre-prehistoric limestone. It is this polished surface, in fact, that now takes over, demanding your full sensorial attention. It forces you to slow down, to be of full command of your balance. And it even encourages you to reflect on the countless pilgrims to this sacred locale, on the many millions of feet which have made this surface so slippery, and forces you also to recollect the extensive archaeological clearings of this site, clearings that removed most of the soil in the attempt to cleanse the sacred rock from the rubble and the material traces of its other lives, the remnants of post-classical periods, the reminders of conquest and barbarity. Walking is recollection. This is a subaltern history of the site, a history according to our feet.
Slowly narrow till they reach the capitals, and the columns are not parallel. If we prolong the columns, they meet each other. They form three pyramids between 1,600 and 2,000 meters. If these columns were parallel, it would give us that impression. They are made like a pyramid, so they seem to be parallel. And the golden mean, that's that they didn't have, for example, eight columns at the short elevation and then 16 at the long. It's 17, it's plus one, 17, eight. We count twice.
Come out, please, come out.
But before we rush to admire the Parthenon, and take the obligatory snapshot, let me show you something else. You need to follow me down this path and down some stairs and into this cliff towards the ancient agora. You will see then, amidst the rubble and the amorphous broken marble, the tops of Muslim tombstones, most probably fashioned out of classical architectural fragments. Now, you did not expect to find this here. And yet, for centuries, the area on the foot of the Acropolis was a Muslim burial ground. And you did not expect to see this either, half buried in rubble, yet still visible. In fact, this you can touch too. After all, there is no sign to discourage you, as this was not meant to be here. It is not in fact part of the official repertoire of objects, not part of the approved and sanctioned itinerary, not listed in the tourist guides, not the site you came here for. And yet, it is an architectural fragment from the Erechtheion, no less, the second most important ruin of the Acropolis after the Parthenon. At the beginning of the 19th century, an inscription in Arabic was added on it, praising the ruler of the Acropolis for his effort to fortify the site. Then, the piece was embedded above one of the main gates to the site. Now, what time is this piece? How can we date it using the conventional methods of... hearing comes from this basement, inconspicuous, unmarked, humble. And it was the chant of prayer, coming out of one of the many informal and unrecognized mosques in Athens. The only mosques, that is. There are no official recognized ones. Now, I know you came to Athens not to see the mosques in shoddy basements, nor to taste the delicious dishes of its Indian and Pakistani restaurants. You came to see the ruins. No, not the ruins that the worst crisis since the Second World War is currently producing, the other ruins, the positively valued ones. And that's why I'm taking you to the Acropolis. Western modernity wanted to tame distant times, to colonize the faraway places, and to prove the antiquity and the material truths of the nation. To be more precise, if modernity, to recall Heidegger, produced the world as picture, modernist archaeology produced the world as object, an entity that was more of a philosophical concept than a material reality, an entity separate from the subject, the autonomous human, and one that could be engaged with through the distant senses and primarily through autonomous vision. Instead of presence, it opted for representation. Instead of material things, it opted for mostly anesthetic objects. Objects that could be rendered legible and visible, put up on a pedestal, admired from a distance, and then framed through various representational devices. The flat drawing, the photograph, the computer screen, and remote sensing and scanning technologies. But it is the thingness of the thing that continues to haunt us. The memory of its physical interaction with humans, the tactility and the evocation of lost, but not forgotten, auditory, olfactory, and gustatory worlds continue to disturb the sleep of modernist archaeology. Things will not rest until they get their sensorial dues. In the new Acropolis Museum, this new museoscape of oblivion,
yes, sir.
So far removed from the intensely multisensorial neighborhood that you just left behind. Before you even enter its brutalist shell, you know that you are already in the domain of austere sensoriality, structured and regimented by autonomous vision. This is a museoscape of both spectacle and surveillance. Glass facades that reflect the surroundings, especially the monumental landscape of the Acropolis itself, X-ray machines at the entrance, glass floors between the different levels, and of course the omnipresent glass cases filled with artifacts that were meant to be admired visually and from a distance. Please don't take any photos. You'll be stopped by the guards. The dissemination of visual signifiers is the exclusive prerogative of the museum authorities. You're promised a museum that will tell you the story of the monument opposite, from geological formation to the present. And yet, you're presented again with the story of the achievements of the classical era. Who is the Acropolis before and after the classical? Who is the medieval, the Byzantine, the Ottoman, the early modern? In this temple of forgetting, you come mostly to worship yourself, your ancestral achievements, your European supremacy. You're already on the top floor and the Parthenon Gallery. Here, you're allowed to take pictures. And most people do, especially pictures of monuments opposite, the monument opposite. This is a new, increasingly fashionable vantage point from which to admire and to photograph the Acropolis. You have already realized that you are subjected to various technologies of the management of attention. And the aim, of course, is sensorial consensus.
Excuse me, ma'am. Is there a rule of how can you pose next to the statues and stuff?
How can you pose?
Yeah, I mean, because I was told that.
Yes, well, definitely here you cannot take any photo at all when you turn right. on the other half of this floor and on the third you can. So just be more, I mean, you don't do something like have your tongue out or something.
Okay.
Yes, with...
Okay.
As you feel it, but you understand.
Yeah, I would just, if it was somebody's thing or if it's a rule in the museum or something.
If you do something extreme, they will tell you
okay,
not
okay.
to do it.
Just, I will do it. Thank you.
And yet, the sensual practices were enacted in this museum even before its completion. When digging for the foundations of the building, remnants of the late classical medieval Athens came to the surface, almost involuntarily, material memories of a past that refuses to be erased. They became a major point of contention, and activists would film the excavation from nearby balconies and post the clips on YouTube, creating a new space of sensorial attention, a dissensual effect. At the end, these ruins won the right to be exhibited in the foundations of the building. And the photographs you took downstairs secretly, when the guards were looking the other way, are traces of dissensual practices too. And so is the act of this man. At another landscape of oblivion, in fact, the museoscape that the New Acropolis Museum cites and attempts to respond to. In the British Museum, during a demonstration for the return of the Parthenon marbles, this protester attempted to cross a border, to ignore the rope, to disregard the museographic imperative, do not touch. It was an act of touching things, things which are considered in the national imagination as exiled and imprisoned marbles, and it was the feeling with one's skin, the skin of the marble, that engendered these sensual effects, that created an environment of sensorial and corporeal affectivity, that produced a unified community of things and persons. The exploration of the senses is not merely about corporeal experience. It is not about sensory organs and the mechanics of the bodily stimuli. It is rather an inquiry on the essence of being, on life, on the nature of the subject-object and mind-body dichotomies. Critical historiographies on the senses, as well as several anthropological studies, have shown that the sensorium, with its five senses and its implicit hierarchy, is a Western folk taxonomy, and we inherited it since classical antiquity. It is a way of imagining the self and the body, an imagery that in colonial and national imagination, modernity, took on a rigid form. This prevailing conception of the sense in Western modernity, however, carried certain class connotations. It had mostly to do with the upper and middle classes, whereas there were other subaltern sensorial regimes that defied sensorial hierarchy and compartmentalization. Furthermore, this fixity and regimentation has been challenged in late modernity, especially since the beginning of the 20th century, by new social forces, new technologies, new configurations of materiality. Things can be described as extensions of the human body. They can act as sensorial prostheses. This is not meant to devalue their power and agency, but rather to foreground and highlight their ability to enable the body to expand its sensorial capabilities. And since things are infinite, sensorial modalities are also infinite. Several unrecognized sensorial modalities have been defined and analyzed by anthropology, cultural studies, or other fields. The sense of temperature, the sense of balance and movement, kinesthesia, and the sense of cinema, synesthesia with C, are some of them. We can go on adding, for example, the sense of place. The specific experiential mode associated with the emplacement of human action, its grounding in specific locales, the familiarity that such a grounding brings, the almost instinctive and automatic sense of sensorial recognition of paths and routes and features, the gathering and the harboring of memories in places, all sensorial experiences are synesthetic, but also kinesthetic. All involve movement as well as the commingling and the combined work of several senses. Sensorial modalities are thus are infinite, not only because of the infinity of things, but also because of the infinite number of contextual situations and locales where sensorial experience take place. Now, the implications of this thesis are immense. In the same way that anthropologists have identified sensorial modalities unrecognized by the Western sensorium, archaeologists, having primary access to the materiality of the world through time, to the infinite number and range of things and technologies, can unearth and explore sensorial modalities which have been ignored and suppressed by Western modernity. Given the synesthetic nature and character of sensoriality, however, this will have to be done without resorting to the enumeration and the singularization of the sensorial. Now that you have been to the museum, let me take you to the site itself. But as we ascend the hill and pass the monumental entrance, be very careful. The slope is very slippery. You are prohibited again from touching the marble, but at least your feet can touch the ground, the polished rock, reminding you that before civilization, before the classical, before even the prehistoric citadel that stood in this place, this was geology, bedrock, pre-prehistoric limestone. It is this polished surface, in fact, that now takes over, demanding your full sensorial attention. It forces you to slow down, to be of full command of your balance. And it even encourages you to reflect on the countless pilgrims to this sacred locale, on the many millions of feet which have made this surface so slippery, and forces you also to recollect the extensive archaeological clearings of this site, clearings that removed most of the soil in the attempt to cleanse the sacred rock from the rubble and the material traces of its other lives, the remnants of post-classical periods, the reminders of conquest and barbarity. Walking is recollection. This is a subaltern history of the site, a history according to our feet.
Slowly narrow till they reach the capitals, and the columns are not parallel. If we prolong the columns, they meet each other. They form three pyramids between 1,600 and 2,000 meters. If these columns were parallel, would give us that impression. They are made like a pyramid, so they seem to be parallel. And the golden mean, that's that they didn't have, for example, eight columns at the short elevation and then 16 at the long. It's 17, it's plus one, 17, eight. We count twice.
Come out, please, come out.
But before we rush to admire the Parthenon and take the obligatory snapshot, let me show you something else. You need to follow me down this path and down some stairs and into this cliff towards the ancient agora. You will see then, amidst the rubble and the amorphous broken marble, the tops of Muslim tombstones was probably fashioned out of classical architectural fragments. Now, you did not expect to find this here. And yet, for centuries, the area on the foot of the Acropolis was a Muslim burial ground. And you did not expect to see this either. Half buried in rubble, yet still visible. In fact, this you can touch too. After all, there is no sign to discourage you, as this was not meant to be here. It is not, in fact, part of the official repertoire of objects, not part of the approved and sanctioned itinerary, not listed in the tourist guides, not the site you came here for. And yet, it is an architectural fragment from the Erechtheion, no less, the second most important ruin of the Acropolis after the Parthenon. At the beginning of the 19th century, an inscription in Arabic was added on it, praising the ruler of the Acropolis for his effort to fortify the site. Then, the piece was embedded above one of the main gates to the site. Now, what time is this piece? How can we date it using the conventional methods of archaeology? Is it classical, 5th century BC? Is it Ottoman and of the 19th century? Or does it belong to many different times? Does it not embody, in a material and tactile sense, the coexistence of past and present, the enactment of time as multi-temporality rather than succession? The sensorial consensus of contemporary Athens wants to erase its Muslim presence, but its Ottoman, Arabic, or simply other pasts refuse to be erased. They make their presence felt in a tangible and forceful manner. Even atop of the monument that embodies the golden age of Western civilization. Let's take a stroll now. From anthropology to contemporary art, this is the era of the thing. The thing turn has been certainly a welcome move. It has forced us to pay specific attention to the textures of the world, to the attributes and properties of materials, to the thingness and the agency of things. At the same time, it shifted the focus away from the philosophically problematic notion of the object, which assumes a separate entity, the subject, posit against it in a dichotomous manner. But there is a danger that such an emphasis on things will lead to fetishization, to the creation of artificial separation between things and bodies, things and environments, and amongst things, the landscape, the atmosphere, the weather. I'm not evoking here the well-known Marxian critique of alienation, mystification, and isolation of things as commodities. I express instead a concern that the overemphasis on things ignores all the sensorial and life processes that take place in that space which is in between things, humans, other beings, all other cosmic elements. Instead of the body, then, as a unified and bounded entity, I propose we should shift our attention to sensoriality and corporeality as conditions of embodiment, or better, to transcorporeality. The condition of sensorial flows in shifting corporeal landscapes, which also include and encompass things. Now, this is a shift from the body or from the thing to the field of experience and to a carnal materiality which recognizes that a unified element of bodies, organisms, things, environments, and landscapes is their flesh, in the sense of Merleau-Ponty. That is, their sensorial character and nature, which comes to life through transcorporeal affective entanglements and engagements. This is an ontology not of things, but of sensorial flows and movements, not of bodies, but of corporeal landscapes, of transcorporeality, not of single action, but of continuous interanimation. A body is an organism, but at the same time extends itself beyond the organic. Since the senses, despite their functional roles, are not absolutely essential, necessary for the organic body to operate. But then, what is their primary role? Sensoriality shapes and organizes social life. Perhaps more importantly, it activates and evokes affectivity. The senses enable the body to be affected. They allow us to be touched, to be moved. Sensoriality thus cannot be separated from affect. It is through affectivity that sensorial flows and interactions animate the flesh of the world. Now, the notion of the flow is of prime importance here. It refers to flows of materials, information, substances, memories, affects, airborne particles, bodily fluids, ideas, rays of light, waves of sound. There is, however, constantly a dialectic in operation between fluidity and fixity, between sensorial flows and interactions on the one hand, and objectification and regulation on the other. The same applies to bodily and sensorial memories. War memorials is one example of fixity and objectification. Archaeological monuments and sites, they constituted out of scattered material traces of the past, is another example of such attempts at objectification, fixity, and regulation. Their aim is to produce and perpetuate a consensual order. Now, these attempts are constantly at risk, however. They are subject to the involuntary as well as voluntary mnemonic effects, to the subaltern efforts to disrupt the consensus, to produce a dissensus. Now that you had enough of monumentalized landscapes, enough of sensorial regimentation, I brought you down here to the North Slope in an area which has suffered less from the extensive ritualized purification compared to other parts of this monumental landscape. Here in the Monastiraki, we are amongst traces of different times and different cultures. Here, where a few years back, when excavations were conducted to build the new metro station, the new metro line, an ancient buried river, covered since Roman times, called Eridanos, burst into the surface, upsetting all plans. Here, where activists and architects had to fight hard to convince authorities to allow that river to be held, to remain uncovered, the river that was found alive, as some of them said. So plans for a glass roof over it had to be cancelled. And talking of flow, I brought you down here for another reason. I wanted you to hear the drums, the flows of sound that come from this sensorial assemblage that gathers here every evening, especially during the weekends. Watch and listen. Dance with them if you wish. Become part of this transcorporeal landscape. A heterogeneous sensorial assemblage composed of people, mostly of African origin, but also of passers-by, of musical instruments, of the ambient light and sound, the Byzantine church, the metro station, the defunct Ottoman mosque, now a folk museum, the atmospherical elite acropolis. No matter how tightly the sensorial regimes of modernity are regulated, there are always going to be space for dissensual affects, for dangerous assemblages to come into existence. Thank you very much.